Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, Guns in America, a damning new report on the law enforcement response to the Uvalde school massacre shows failures on multiple fronts as more mass shootings take place across the U.S. Then, at the extreme, Europe struggles with major wildfires and energy uncertainty amid a massive continent-wide heat wave. And a call to arms, how increasingly violent rhetoric is becoming a dangerous feature of Republican campaigns and party messaging.
You have a bipartisan system in which one of those two parties has left democracy to the point of fomenting a coup attempt.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Police in suburban Indianapolis are looking for answers after the country's latest mass shooting. A man armed with two rifles killed three people in a mall food court last night. Investigators say a bystander, legally armed with a handgun, then shot and killed the gunman. We'll have more on this and on other mass shootings after the news summary. A heat wave is scorching the central U.S. with temperatures at dangerous levels. Extreme heat warnings were issued across the West, Midwest, and South today. Readings ranged from 100 degrees in Fargo, North Dakota, and Tulsa, Oklahoma, to 110 in Dallas. Officials in Texas warned that power use could break records again this week as customers crank up the air conditioning. A separate heat wave that's been searing southern Europe moved north into Britain today. Temperatures topped 100 degrees, shutting schools and train lines and closing some airports after runways melted. The heat has also fueled wildfires in France and Spain, displacing thousands of people. And heat-related deaths are in the hundreds. We'll return to all of this later in the program. In Ukraine, Russia continued its campaign of heavy shelling, killing even more civilians. Rescuers scoured the remnants of a residential building in the eastern town of Toretsk after a missile strike there killed at least six people. Meanwhile, in Moscow, President Putin remained defiant over Western sanctions. He insisted that Russia won't let itself be cut off.
We cannot develop in isolation from the rest of the world, and it won't be like that. Today, you can't just circle everything with a compass and put up a huge fence around yourself.
Putin plans to travel to Iran tomorrow. U.S. officials have warned that Tehran plans to supply the Russians with more drones. The acting president of Sri Lanka today declared a state of emergency, giving himself broad power even as protesters demand his resignation. He warned that demonstrators may face a tougher response going forward.
In this country today, there's a campaign to violate the law. What we have to do is oppose this and protect law and order. I will not allow fascists to destroy the country's law and order. At the same time, I will accept peaceful protesters.
Despite the warning, members of trade unions protested outside the main railway terminal in the capital city of Colombo. They insisted they will not back down. The island nation's former president fled the country last week and resigned amid economic collapse and political unrest. On the pandemic, several large Chinese cities, including Shanghai, are rolling out new mass testing and limited lockdowns as COVID-19 infections are on the rise. That comes as new subvariants of the virus once again are pushing cases higher around the world. The New York Times reports average daily cases in the U.S. are up 15% in the last 2 weeks. Hospitalizations are up 20%. Meanwhile, Wall Street lost ground after early gains faded. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 215 points to close at 31,072. The NASDAQ fell 92 points and the S&P 500 slipped 32. Still to come on the NewsHour, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon faces trial for contempt of Congress. Our Politics Monday team breaks down the latest headlines. A new book makes the case for Ricky Henderson as one of baseball's all-time greats, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Let's return now to our top story, the continuing epidemic of shootings and gun-related deaths in America. From Indiana to Texas to Florida and many other places, communities, families, and individuals are coping today with the aftermath of violence that remains all too routine. Gun violence in America shows no sign of slowing as the nation faced another weekend of mass shootings. Sunday evening at an Indianapolis mall, an alleged gunman identified as 20-year-old Jonathan Sapirman shot and killed three people and injured two more. Police say an armed civilian then shot and killed the gunman.
Many more people would have died last night if not for a responsible armed citizen that took action very quickly within the first 2 minutes of this shooting.
The Gun Violence Archive reports 15 mass shootings this weekend, in which four or more people were shot. They count more than 350 so far this year. On Sunday, new details from Uvalde, Texas, revealed, quote, systemic failures in response to the shooting at Robb Elementary School. The 77-page report from a Texas House committee found nearly 400 local, state, and federal officers were on scene, but with no clear leadership, they, quote, failed to prioritize saving the lives of innocent victims over their own safety.
The training and standards we set for officers is if you know there is active shooting, active killing going on, or somebody is dying, the standard is you have to continue to do something to stop that killing or stop that dying. That day, several officers in the hallway or in that building knew or should have known there was dying in that classroom. And they should have done more, acted with urgency.
Little solace for the grieving families in Uvalde. Sergio Garcia's 9-year-old son, Uzziah, was one of the 19 children killed.
Whatever I see in this report is not going to bring my son back. But we need to prevent it so somebody else won't lose their son, their daughter, their kids. This needs to be the last time this happens to a school.
Meanwhile, the ripple effects of gun violence continue across other American communities. In Florida today, opening statements in the death penalty trial of the gunman in the 2018 Parkland High School shooting. The prosecution began to make its case.
The murders, all 17, were heinous, atrocious, and cruel. All 17 were cold, calculated, and premeditated.
Also today, in Buffalo, New York, the gunman who allegedly killed 10 black people at a grocery store was arraigned on federal hate crime charges. In Highland Park, Illinois today, the final funeral for the victims of the July 4th parade shooting. Just one of the many communities still in mourning and waiting for justice to be served. Well, this afternoon, the Texas State Police announced it would do its own review after the Uvalde report laid out systemic failures and detailed, quote, egregiously poor decision-making by law enforcement. It found 376 officers responded that day, representing 20 different agencies. Yet there was a lack of effective incident command, and it was unclear who was in charge. The report also outlines how school staff developed a sense of complacency with safety protocols, leaving doors unlocked or propped open for convenience. I'm joined now by Tony Plahetsky. He's an investigative reporter for the Austin American-Statesman who has closely covered the Robb Elementary shooting and its fallout since that tragic day. Tony, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you for joining us. As we mentioned, you have covered this from the beginning. So what stands out to you from this report? What's news to you?
I think this report is filled with so many wrenching revelations, and it really does paint the most complete picture of what happened that horrible day. Keep in mind that over the past 7.5 weeks, we have gotten information in drips and drabs. And unfortunately, so much of that information has proven to be false. And authorities have found themselves having to amend statements or correct them, or in some cases, throw them out altogether. So the fact that we now have a written report that is based on the testimony of dozens of people, including many law enforcement officials there, it really does paint the scene. Tragically, though, the more information we learn from going through this report, it really is renewing so much pain and so much loss for the families of Uvalde. And it really does show just such an epic failure of law enforcement and responding to everything that was going on that day.
You know, Tony, when you think back to those early days, I remember so much focus, especially from state officials, pointing the blame at Uvalde police, specifically the school district police chief, Pete Arredondo, whose name we've heard so much now. But this report shows there were multiple failures by multiple officers from multiple agencies. We need to stress officials have known about this for weeks. So why are we just learning about that part of it now?
Well, certainly there has been a narrative that frankly has been nurtured, which is that the responding officers were from a small town. They were out of their depth. They truly were the ones who did not respond appropriately. But to your point, we now know from this report that there were law enforcement agencies there at the state level as well as the federal level, including the Texas Department of Public Safety. The Border Patrol was also on the ground there as well. And as a matter of fact, this report makes it clear that the majority of the police officers who responded to the school were in fact state and federal law enforcement. So the idea that this was just a small town problem really does get thrown out when you consider the number of officers who were there, and from the, all of the different agencies, the multitude of agencies. And I think today, as we continue to make sense of all of this, it only serves to deepen the question about law enforcement training and law enforcement response for active shooter situations like this one.
Tony, I'm sure this is small comfort for the families who had to bury children, bury loved ones, many of them forever traumatized, even if they survived. We know many of them were raising concerns about a potential cover-up as well. How has this report fed any of those narratives, and how are they responding to these latest revelations?
Well, certainly among those 21 families and the people of Uvalde, there's no real uniform response from this information, but I can certainly tell you that many people within that town are very, very angry. They are heartbroken. This has renewed their grief, but also at the same time, I think many of them are also taking some solace, if that is even possible, in knowing the facts, as difficult as they are to comprehend and make sense of. Many of them are taking some comfort in knowing what happened that terrible day and not having just all of these unanswered questions out there.
Tony, briefly, if you can, what about accountability? I mean, we know the school district police chief has been put on leave. The mayor's also put the acting police chief for the city on leave. Do we know what happens next?
That's a question that we have been, in fact, asking today. We know that the Texas Department of Public Safety has also created an internal committee to look at the response of its officers, but we are actually in the process of polling all of the agencies now to see if they will similarly do an internal review of officers' action.
That is Tony Plahetsky of the Austin American-Statesman, who has been following that massacre at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Tony, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
While scorching heat, buckling roads, raging fires, and hundreds dead already, an intense heat wave has gripped much of Europe. Today in the town of Nantes, France, a reading of 107.6 Fahrenheit. Temperatures touched 100 in the UK. Paris, London, and Rome inched closer to 100. Madrid was 102. It is the worst heat wave in years. And as special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports, most of Europe cannot cope.
It's Sunday afternoon in the English Channel. We're just off Dover. We've just left. And before we got on the ship, the temperature was a very pleasant 75 degrees Fahrenheit. But we're just racing ahead of a North African weather system which is sweeping north, which is going to send temperatures in Britain this week to a record-breaking 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a red warning. Normally in Britain, people like a little bit of sunshine, but this sort of temperature could kill people. The British reputation for keeping cool and carrying on evaporated in tropical temperatures. Trafalgar Square became a spa for the day.
Well, you walk from shadow to shadow, so anywhere that you have to stay in the sun for a long time, that's off limits. So you will have to deal with sticking in places like we are now, as opposed to walking next to the Thames or any place like that.
Although the Mercury didn't reach predicted heights, it was brutal enough for the British. Infrastructure wilted. The Farnborough Air Show coped with the heat.
It was hot.
But runways at a military base and a main tourist airport melted, and flights were suspended. But beneath their bearskins, ceremonial soldiers maintained the composure expected of a Coldstream guard. On the European mainland, close to the Mediterranean, wildfires raged out of control, causing thousands to flee their homes. The situation has been dire in Spain and Portugal, where more than 1,000 people have died from the summer heat, not the flames. Firefighter Pedro José Vara.
We are scared. There's a tomato plantation over there. If the wind changes this way, it burns down my parents' house. And if it changes that way, it burns down my wife's work. That's practically what we live on.
As the French headed to their beaches in droves, experts were warning of a heat apocalypse. According to latest reports, several hundred people have died in France. Fears about fatalities crossed the border to Germany. It's just after lunchtime. I'm in northern Germany, heading for a ferry to take me to Denmark. I'm ahead of the heat wave. The temperature for most of the day has been around about 77 degrees Fahrenheit. But tomorrow there is a heat warning for this region of Germany. The big news out of the country today is that at a climate conference, scientists have warned that the world is facing catastrophe because it's just not going to meet the targets to keep temperature rise down to 1.5 degrees centigrade. In fact, they're predicting it'll be 3 degrees centigrade. At the conference, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had this warning.
Half of humanity is in the danger zone from floods, droughts, extreme storms and wildfires. No nation is immune. Yet we continue to feed our fossil fuel addiction.
And Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, warned that Russia's invasion of Ukraine was exacerbating the climate crisis.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine is exacerbating a global energy and food crisis that is pushing millions into poverty, hunger, and starvation. And while we are still grappling with the fallout from the pandemic, the impacts of climate change are becoming even more dangerous across the world.
As I headed further north on the ferry to Denmark, the temperatures cooled. The ship had a hybrid power system using electric batteries to reduce reliance on traditional diesel engines. It's an effort to curb climate change, but it's just not enough. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in Denmark.
Well, as high as temperatures have been in recent days, forecasters are expecting even hotter days in some parts of Europe tomorrow. Stephanie Tsai gets the perspective of a climate scientist in Europe watching all of this.
Now let's focus more on the underlying reasons behind this extreme heat wave and the risks. Joining us now is Emily Shockborough, the director of Cambridge Zero, the University of Cambridge's climate change initiative. Professor Shockborough, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. You've had several heat waves over the years, but does this summer feel different? Does it feel more worrisome to you?
The mood here really is different. I think that we've now seen in the UK and across Europe, summer after summer, with heat waves that are causing real human hardship, whether that's in terms of the number of people who have died or just even the disruption to daily life, the terrifying wildfires that are impacting communities. But we've also seen across Europe the devastation caused by flooding events as well. I was in southern France a few weeks ago, and devastating floods in southern France from 2 years ago. You can still see the immense damage that's occurred as a consequence of that. So it's very much the case in the UK and throughout Europe that everyone knows somebody who's being affected by the impacts of climate change. And I think that has changed the mood, and people really are starting to realize that climate change isn't any longer a problem of tomorrow. It's a problem that's affecting people economically, and affecting people in terms of human lives today.
Here in Phoenix, Arizona, to have a triple-digit day is the norm, but most people have air conditioners. Are people having to adopt the infrastructure of hotter summers there because you're starting to see these extreme heat waves more often?
Well, that's exactly the point. Of course, there are many parts of the United States that experience hotter temperatures, you know, on a daily basis throughout the summer months. But you have air conditioning and your infrastructure is adapted to that. In the UK, very few homes have air conditioning. And to adapt, to change our infrastructure entirely to cope with these higher temperatures, the costs would be prohibitive. And so it's a real challenge as to how we cope with the climate change that we're already seeing today.
One of the topics that's come up in the climate change discussion here is how inflation and high energy prices is changing the conversation away from greener renewable energies toward let's lower gas prices. How do you combat that change in tone as we face inflation and high energy prices?
Well, again, it's very difficult coming from the UK to really identify with that position. Very much the narrative here in the UK is that the current cost of living crisis, which is very real, is at heart an energy crisis, as you described, but it's a fossil fuel driven energy crisis. And if we can move our economy away from that dependency on fossil fuels, embracing renewable energy technologies, reducing our reliance on energy in the UK, a large amount of our energy is used to heat our homes in winter. If we better insulate our homes, then we would have less reliance on the need for energy in the first place. So across a range of measures to reduce our reliance on the volatile fossil fuel economy and to embrace a new economy with greater energy security is very much the way that we're looking at this. Again, thinking of the opportunities that we can embrace.
I know that you have met with members of parliament there in Britain, that you are at a press conference alongside the chief scientist in the country recently. Do you feel that the government is responsive to your message?
Well, in the UK, we have a target of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. And the government has responded last year with a detailed plan as to how to do that across all sectors of the economy. There's still further progress that needs to be made in critical sectors. I mentioned the challenge of heating our homes and switching that heating from fossil fuel driven to renewable sources. That's a major shift of our infrastructure. There's also challenges in terms of looking at our agriculture and land use. But there are other areas where progress is really already being made, particularly in the transport sector, where electric vehicles are taking off and the uptake is, I think, exceeding all possible expectations in terms of the growth of electric vehicles. So there are signs of progress. The key difference between the UK and many other countries, including the United States, is that we have a strategy as to how to do this transition. It might not be complete enough in all respects, but it's a start. And if other countries could adopt a similar approach to putting together a detailed plan, a detailed strategy, and embracing the economic opportunities that are associated with a net zero transition, then we might, as a global society, be able to respond to climate change with the scale and urgency required.
Emily Shockbrough, the director of Cambridge Zero, thank you for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you.
Jury selection began today in the trial of former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, who faces criminal contempt of Congress charges after refusing to comply with the January 6th Select Committee. John Yang has more on the trial and the role it plays in the broader investigation.
Amna, Bannon is the first member of Trump's inner circle to go on trial for defying a committee subpoena. Jury selection started slowly today, with Bannon's attorney asking potential jurors how much of the hearings they've watched and whether they have opinions about the committee and its work. Devlin Barrett covers the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Devlin, people may be confused here because the headline last week was that Bannon said he was willing to testify before the committee, and yet this trial, this contempt trial, is underway. So help people understand what's going on here.
So a lot of what you saw Bannon doing last week and the week before, I think you have to really see in context of him trying to delay his trial. And essentially, he did make that offer to testify to the committee, but it was such a last-minute thing And, you know, he was charged, like, this, the events that led to this trial all came last year. And so what prosecutors and frankly, the judge as well, have said to Bannon's last minute offers is, you know, it's really too late for that. You refused to cooperate with the committee, allegedly, and now there's going to be a trial over exactly how that happened.
Is this likely, or it is a possible outcome of this, that he will cooperate with the committee and comply with the subpoena?
You know, one of the real ironies of charging someone with contempt of Congress is it's really just a punishment. If anything, it makes it less likely that he will end up testifying to the committee, because there's now a potential conviction or a potential appeal of these legal issues, all of which would make it harder for him to testify, not easier. This is really just the stick of punishment now for someone that they decided was not going to deal with them.
He's been arguing that he doesn't have to testify or appear or comply because he's covered by executive privilege. Is that something the judge has said he can argue in his defense?
The judge has left open the idea that he may be able to argue to the jury that he was still willing to cooperate, or he had some interest, newfound willingness to cooperate. But this executive privilege argument, I think, has been misunderstood or mischaracterized, because the judge also said, we don't even know that the president invoked executive privilege in this case. We are essentially taking that from the defendant's lawyers, saying that it was invoked. And one of the real core simple issues in this trial is, did Steve Bannon, or did he not, get a subpoena from the committee with a certain date by which he was supposed to testify and give documents? And did he give them any of those things? Or did he at least explain why he wasn't going to give them those things, or have some sort of back and forth with them about it? And the prosecution argument is that he didn't. He basically said and did nothing of value, and that is what led to the charge.
And so this is a very narrow set of facts that they're going to be trying in this case.
Extremely narrow. So narrow, in fact, that, you know, jury selection may take 1 or 2 days here. It's possible this is one of the rare cases where the trial itself could be shorter than the jury selection. That is how narrow the law and the facts are at issue here. But again, you can't know for sure until you see what some of the defense decisions are and what kind of case they try to present.
Aside from this issue of whether of contempt of Congress for allegedly not complying or ignoring this subpoena from the January 6th committee, is it possible that Steve Bannon could be part of a broader Justice Department investigation into January 6th?
So what we've seen is that the January 6th investigation is incredibly broad and encompasses hundreds of people and a lot of different conduct. And certainly as one of the public mouthpieces and boosters of January 6th, Steve Bannon is in the mix in a lot of that activity. So separate and apart from this case, which is just about the narrow question of contempt, I do think it's reasonable to think that Steve Bannon is sort of in the Justice Department's field of vision as they look at all the events leading up to January 6th.
And Devlin, remind us, what's the possible penalty for these contempt charges that he's facing in trial?
So he faces two charges. Each charge carries a minimum jail term of a month or a maximum of a year. To be honest, the case history, though, no one's gone to jail for this as long as anyone's been alive. So this is in some ways making an example of Steve Bannon. A lot of the Steve Bannon trial is not so much about Steve Bannon. It's about sending a message to all the other people who have been subpoenaed by the committee.
Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The House Select Committee investigating the attack on the U.S. Capitol has presented new evidence in recent hearings on how former President Donald Trump stoked violence leading up to and on January 6th. And this week, the committee will focus on Trump's actions during those 187 minutes of the insurrection itself. But as Laura Barrón-López reports, the escalation and normalization of violent rhetoric has extended beyond Trump, becoming a dangerous feature of Republican campaign and party messaging. We begin with last week's hearing.
A very, very brief overview.
A direct line from former President Donald Trump's words to violence.
I was hanging on every word he was saying. Everything he was putting out, I was following it.
Stephen Ayers was following Trump's lies that he won the 2020 presidential election. He followed Trump's tweet to be there on January 6th.
We're going to the Capitol.
And he followed the call to march from the White House to the United States Capitol.
Why'd you decide to march to the Capitol?
So we basically were just following what he said.
The committee charges that the violence on the 6th was the culmination of weeks of escalatory rhetoric by Trump, that when all legal avenues to challenge the election failed, January 6th was a last stand, where Trump was willing to accept violence to stay in power. But Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a history professor at New York University who studies authoritarian governments, says the seeds of January 6th go back even further to Trump's rise.
When you look back at the past 6 years, what do you see as the watershed moments?
The campaign of 2016 was a watershed in terms of the beginning of a systematic attempt by Trump and people around him to shift our political culture from a democracy to an authoritarian one. And what that meant was he was speaking about violence as something positive.
Like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
And he was in a way kind of having an emotional retraining of Americans to say, you know, violence against your neighbor, it doesn't always have to be bad.
In 2015, that meant rallies that ended with fistfights and assault charges. In 2017, neo-Nazis felt emboldened to march on Charlottesville.
Very fine people on both sides.
In 2021, a deadly assault on the nation's capital. Ahead of this year's midterm elections, Trump's style and message are still as popular as ever, spawning a rise in the use of violent language and imagery in Republican campaign ads.
We're going rhino hunting.
When this rifle is the only thing standing between your family and a dozen angry Democrats in Klan hoods, you just might need that semi-automatic.
To get ahead in the GOP now, you need to be espousing this kind of violent rhetoric. People who are candidates, like Mehmet Oz, who was running for Senate in Pennsylvania, he used to be for gun reform. But you can't do that now because the party has radicalized.
They're dead wrong.
So instead, he showed himself shooting a gun and parroting this very common propaganda point that the Second Amendment is no longer about hunting or recreation. It's to, use arms to overthrow a tyrannical government.
But our Second Amendment is not just about hunting. It's about our constitutional right to protect ourselves from intruders or an overly intrusive government.
In Washington, Republicans have been slow to condemn the violent rhetoric or have remained silent. Responding to Eric Greitens' ad targeting Republicans in name only, known as RINOs, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said it was up to individuals to decide what they will accept.
Well, I think this is something that voters in the Missouri Republican primary need to take a look at.
And in the House, members of GOP leadership have themselves amplified the same racist conspiracies espoused by mass shooters. In May, a mass shooter killed 10 people in a Buffalo, New York grocery store. His online posts showed he was inspired by the racist and anti-Semitic, quote, great replacement conspiracy, writing that mass immigration will disenfranchise us, subvert our nations, and destroy our communities.
Democrats' one-party rule in Washington.
Experts saw echoes of that ideology in a Facebook ad posted last year by the third-ranking Republican in the House, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York. The ad accused Democrats of planning a permanent election insurrection through a plan to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants who would overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. Stefanik's spokesperson called criticism that she was amplifying the Great Replacement theory a disgusting low for the left. Republicans have sought to label Democrats as equal actors in encouraging violence by pointing to some Black Lives Matter protests that devolved into looting and damaged property. Republicans have also tried to censure a Democratic congresswoman for urging protesters to get confrontational.
Democratic politicians, they may use heated words, but they do not pose in their campaign ads or as sitting lawmakers with assault weapons, saying that these assault weapons, you can use them to overthrow the government. They do not espouse oath keepers and other extremists. And so it's not that you can never criticize the Democrats, but it is a false equivalency. And January 6th is proof of that.
More than a year after the attack, Trump refers to the rioters who stormed the Capitol as patriots who deserve pardons.
If I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons.
Ben Ghiat diagnoses Trump's message and the Republicans who stand by him as modern authoritarianism.
Trump presented himself as a victim of a whole democratic system that was out to get him. And the only way to right this wrong was through violence, and that violence would be purifying. It would be patriotic.
She doesn't see a clear exit ramp.
There hasn't been a moment like this with a strict parallel where you have a bipartisan system in which one of those two parties has left democracy to the point of fomenting a coup attempt. And they are unrepentant. And the leader and beneficiary of that coup attempt, which failed, is still in good standing. The other wild card is the availability of guns. So we're in uncharted terrain.
I want to take a moment now to speak directly to my fellow Republicans.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger, one of just two Republicans on the January 6th committee, released disturbing voicemails his office recently received.
I guess I can't say a whole lot more other than I hope you naturally die as quickly as possible, you piece of
What remains unclear is how to reverse the course of escalating violent rhetoric, an embrace of violence within the GOP, and a belief among nearly a third of Republican voters that a civil war may be justified. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone Lopez.
Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill are working to pass a much narrower version of the once ambitious Build Back Better bill, while the White House continues to navigate how best to secure abortion protections after the fall of Roe. To discuss the political stakes of all this, I'm joined now by Tamara Keith of NPR and Annie Linsky of The Washington Post. And Amy Walter is away. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being here.
Thank
I think you. It's fair to say that was a very sobering report from Laura Barone Lopez there. Tam, we have covered, you have covered individual moments like that for years. When you see it pulled together like this, what does it say to you about this moment we're in as a nation?
There is a rising fear in many corners of this country that political violence, that the country is just crackling and ripe for even worse political violence than we've seen thus far. Also, I will add that the QAnon conspiracy theory is full of violent imagery, of fantasies, of assassinations of political enemies, you know, a long list of political enemies taken off to Guantanamo. That imagery is very much part of QAnon, which is very much part of the political dialogue in America on the right. And it can't be ignored.
And you say on the right there, because it's a key point to make. Annie, we just heard their Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell say, look, it's up to the voters to decide if this is acceptable to them or not. It is clear the Republican Party now houses these kinds of conspiracy theorists, extremist ideas, authoritarian ideas. Yeah. Do you see anything among leadership or on the electoral landscape that would change that?
Yeah, I mean, that was such a powerful report. And I think hearing Mitch McConnell's response, which is essentially, let's let the voters decide, is a unique response on the Republican side. I mean, I think Tam is absolutely right that the QAnon theory certainly does have this imagery. But, you know, we have all been to political rallies where, you know, emotions run high and you know, I've been at Democratic events where certain, you know, people in the audience become, you know, say violent things. And the difference is the leadership on the Democratic side will tend to turn the volume down a little bit rather than sort of stepping aside, which is what McConnell is doing, or what some of the other people in the candidates for office in that report are doing, which is really just fostering and normalizing the kind of extreme violence that we are not used to in modern politics.
You feel like it's become normalized on that side, at least?
I mean, you just see so many of those ads, and you're also not seeing the response from the leadership. And to me, those two things, the sort of silence or even the sort of gentle nudging in that direction, combined with it just seeing more and more of it, I mean, that is the path to normalization right there.
Well, we've seen, of course, Democrats come out and condemn it. The president has come out and condemned it several times over, but he's also, of course, got an eye on this quickly closing legislative window. I think it's fair to say, and when we talk about Build Back Better, first of all, it's a phrase we haven't heard a lot of lately. This is not the ambitious plan they once put forward. So what does it mean right now, essentially, when you look at the fact that this plan was brought down by a member of their own party, by Senator Joe Manchin?
As President Biden has said many times over the last year and a half, in a 50-50 Senate, every senator is president. And Joe Manchin has every senator, including Joe Manchin, but especially Joe Manchin, has an outsized vote on these matters. The White House is seemingly willing to try to bag any win that they can get. And so they have pivoted from not really wanting to talk about defeat on the climate measures that were being discussed, and sort of holding out hope, but I don't know what kind of hope they're holding out, to talking about what Joe Manchin will support and what President Biden will take, which is without congressional action, there is going to be a cliff, a huge spike in Obamacare premiums that would hit millions of American families as they're dealing with higher prices on so many things and right before people go to vote in the midterms. So that would be kind of a political nightmare if that is allowed to happen. So this legislation they're talking about, this very, 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 very pared back legislation, would take care of that Obamacare cliff, mm-hmm. and would also allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices. Details obviously still to be worked out. Problems could still arise. But the idea is these are two things that affect Americans, and it's something that Democrats could campaign on as long as they leave out the fact that this big, bold Build Back Better went away.
Those are necessary caveats. So details still to be worked out. Things could still change. Annie, what's your take on this?
You know, I have to say it's sort of very fashionable right now among certain people to, you know, talk about what a terrible job Joe Biden is doing. I mean, his approval rating is awful. And this is a much smaller package than he had conceived of and he had talked about and his people had talked about. That being said, for this to pass a cap on prescription drugs, I mean, it would actually be quite a big win. I mean, even though it's not the giant win, it's not the, medium win, it's still a win. And it's one that, Democrats and Republicans, have diabetes. They both pay for high costs of insulin. And this is the type of legislation that could, help certainly around the edges and perhaps more in the midterms.
Tim, what about the White House response in the fallout after the fall of Roe? They've faced a lot of criticism for not having something ready sooner to respond to that and secure some of those protections. What are they saying about that?
So it seems as though this White House, and the fall of Roe was just the latest example, but this White House is sort of unwilling to flaunt their executive authority. That the president, other presidents do executive actions that amount to basically glorified press releases, but they treat it like a really big deal. And this president has executive actions. Now, maybe there is some criticism that they maybe waited a little bit too long on the executive actions to respond to the Supreme Court decision. But, instead of trumpeting it, President Biden and his team emphasize that, their powers are really limited. There's only so much they can do. It almost seems like they're headed down that path on climate change-related administrative actions as well.
And Annie, in the House, of course, we've seen Democrats taking what action they can. They want to show they're trying, right, even if it doesn't go anywhere in the Senate. But the most coherent message among Democrats right now just seems to be, look, if you want these rights protected, show up in November and vote. Is that fair?
I think that's certainly what's coming from the top of the party. I think it's absolutely not enough for voters. And even you're seeing lawmakers who are, you know, state legislators really pointing the finger to Washington and even to Joe Biden himself, even to President Biden himself, and saying, this is not enough, do better. There's one lawmaker in Texas who came out and said, look, we need a little bit less Washington and playing nice from Joe Biden and a little more Texas, a little more of a rough, edge here. And so they want to see a fighter. And I think, to Tamara's point, I mean, this was not a surprise by any means. And so for Biden to take so long to put out an executive order that surely had been prepared well in advance is sort of mind-boggling to a lot of people. He's just really an imperfect messenger on this particular issue. And has left a lot of Democrats sort of wanting more.
And when we say too long, we should point out, so the leaked draft of that ruling came out in late May, right? The decision in late June. It was 2 weeks, as my recollection is.
Even when the court signaled that they were going to take the case, I mean, arguably there was an entire year to prepare. And certainly ever since the leaked decision came out, it was clear that this was a pretty good signal where the court was going.
During those 2 weeks, President Biden was on an overseas trip dealing with Ukraine and other crises. And then just this last week, he was also on another foreign trip. So he's had a very busy travel schedule. But, you know, this is a White House, as every White House, who says they can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Are we likely to see any other action from them on this front?
I don't think so.
It's hard to see at this point. I mean, I think they've kind of emptied the arsenal. But, I mean, Democrats are still pushing. And if there's anything that this White House has responded to, it has been being pushed from their party.
And also, it may not be a signed executive order. It could well be actions taken at the agency level that don't get as much attention, unless they were to, tout it.
Which they are likely to do, Tam.
Who knows?
We will follow it all. It's certainly very important. Tamara Keith, Annie Linsky, thank you to you both.
You're welcome.
Well, baseball's All-Star Game is tomorrow night, a showcase for the best in the game. That gives us a moment to look back at one of the sport's all-time greats, but one who's hardly a household name these days. Over the course of a career that lasted more than two decades, Rickey Henderson was arguably the greatest leadoff hitter in history and is officially the all-time leader in stolen bases with more than 1,400. He also had 3,000 hits, 2,000 runs, and 2,000 walks. A new book by sports writer Howard Bryant makes the case for Rickey Henderson as an underappreciated historical great. It's called Rickey, The Life and Legend of an American Original. And I spoke with Bryant recently about his latest work. Howard Bryant, welcome back to the NewsHour. Good to have you here. So Rickey Henderson played his last game back in 2003. What made you want to tell his story now?
Well, I think the biggest reason I wanted to talk about him is because he is underappreciated. If it's possible to steal 1,400 bases and be underappreciated and to have 3,000 hits and to really obliterate the record book as he did, I just felt like there aren't as many people as we think who can really carry a full biography, and especially one that is not completely tainted by drugs. And when you write about baseball these days, it feels like it's steroids, steroids, and more steroids. And I wanted to get back and to write a story about somebody who really was a giant in the game and was really going to allow me to dig into some of the issues that really built this last sort of half of the sport where money sort of dominates and where you're looking at a certain type of player that really in a lot of ways doesn't exist anymore. They don't steal bases in baseball anymore. It's a totally different game. He was one of the most exciting, electric, unique players, and I really felt like it was, as he would say as a player, I thought it was Rickey's time.
Did he want his story told? Did you have to convince him?
A lot of convincing. Not really sure he wanted his story told. And what I tried to appeal to him was to say that the stories that get told are not always the best people. The stories that get told are not always the most important. The stories we remember are the ones that get repeated. And to be remembered is to have your story repeated over and over again to make sure people don't forget your greatness. And he's one of the top 10, 15 players who ever played the game. They've been playing baseball since the end of the Civil War. And to be in the top dozen, it's pretty good company.
Let me ask you about his story. He grew up in Oakland, right? His family moved there from Arkansas in 1969. He was just 10 years old. He thought he would be a Raider. He wanted to play pro football, right? How and why did he end up in baseball instead?
He ended up playing baseball because his mother thought he was too small to play football. She was afraid he was going to get hurt and that baseball was the faster path to the major leagues. And it was also the fact that he was just physically gifted. There are so many people who make the big leagues and small percentage of them from any given place. But he comes from a spot where there were so many great players. The legacy of Oakland sports, Bill Russell, Frank Robinson, and Curt Flood, and Beta Pinson, and so many players. I asked Ricky once, when did you believe you had world-class ability? When did you think you could play in the major leagues? And he said, oh, I don't know, sixth grade. I said, you were 12 years old. And so he just had this unbelievable confidence that he was destined to be a great, great player and really saw himself in the Muhammad Ali mold of, it ain't bragging if you can do it.
Well, he went on, he did do it. He became the greatest base stealer of all time. Rod Carew actually shared a funny story last year I saw when he said right before he stole, Ricky would always say out loud, Ricky's got to go, and then take off. And that was just it. So he didn't lack confidence. But, you know, Howard, a lot of people said that he came off as standoffish or egotistical. He referred to himself in the third person. What did he say about that?
Well, I think that if you ask Ricky himself, he'll tell you that he came to win. He came to compete. He came to beat the other guy. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do this book was because it is one of those American stories where he was not a popular player, despite his greatness, despite everything he did. This really is a story of a player who was one of the more disliked players in the early 80s. People, and back in the 80s, there was so much fighting between the Players Association and the league, strikes and lockouts, fighting over money. It's fascinating to me that back then people were so angry that these players, that Ricky was actually asking for the princely sum of $500,000 in his contract. And now you look at the NBA and the NFL and baseball. You got a guy like Russell Westbrook today who just opted into a $47.1 million contract, and people were calling Ricky greedy back then because he wanted a $500,000. But the story arc really is of a guy who wasn't that popular, but by the end, as he goes on, as he grew on us, as he obliterated the record book, then now people want to tell stories about him, and now he's beloved, and they treat him like he's this combination of Satchel Paige and Yogi Berra, where everybody has a Ricky story, just like Rod Carew's. And I wanted to tell that arc of what happens when your greatness sort of wins the public over.
How much of that personality narrative do you think, looking back on that, was attributed to a mostly white sports writing core and any underlying racism, looking at a black player who was among the first to really publicly advocate for himself?
Well, it's a huge piece of it, because who tells your story is as important as the story itself. It's also important to remember once more that when Ricky first came in 1979, free agency was only 5 years old. The public wasn't used to that, and it certainly wasn't used to now having these African-American players be the public face of your franchise, and people viewed them as greedy and selfish, and we all say we want capitalism. And then when you see how much players are actually able to make, then the public didn't love that so much.
Howard, the game is different today than when Ricky was playing, right? The art of the steal mattered so much more back then. Do you think we'll ever see the likes of Ricky Henderson play the game again?
3,000 hits, 2,000 runs, 2,000 walks, 1,400 stolen bases. You're never going to see it again. They don't steal bases anymore. People have said to me during this book tour, what is Ricky's legacy? And sometimes I think, he doesn't have a legacy. He's a unicorn. No one's going to do what he does or what he did, because the game is so totally different. Ricky's work started when he got on first base, so it would be nice to see that again, but that's not how baseball is played anymore.
The book is Ricky, The Life and Legend of an American Original. The author is Howard Bryant. Howard, always good to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you. And I love your baseball. This is great.
And that is the News Hour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS News Hour, thank you for joining us. We'll see you soon.